General Menezes, Reel 13. We're discussing your time on the operations staff of Headquarters Western Command from 1968 to 1969. And we were discussing how the training instructions and operation orders were updated to reflect the lessons of the war with Pakistan, and also the way that the United States was treating both Pakistan and yourselves, the Indians. If you'd like to continue that strand of thought.
Despite President Eisenhower's assurances in 1954 in writing to the Government of India that the Americans would ensure that Pakistan would not be using these weapons, offensive weapons like tanks, heavy artillery, medium artillery, against India, in the event India had said that Pakistan would use them against us and not against the Russians. That, of course, proved true in 1965, but the Americans did not, shall we say, apologize in any way, and they continued their military aid to Pakistan, I mean in terms of money and spares and other facets. So India had now to realize that they needed a friend, in that the treaty was signed with the Soviet Union, the Indo-Soviet Friendship Treaty. And we therefore went in for equipment from the Soviet Union, but not as aid. We bought it from the Soviet Union on rupee credit. We also had to change our posture, because India is basically a continent, though called a subcontinent, and distances are vast and great. So hitherto we had been using the cantonments that the British had left. Now we had to evolve cantonments in new locations. So to have the troops closer to the border on so-called peacetime tenures, but they did not have to move very far to man the borders. So that reduced the, shall we say, the warning time. Otherwise, to say that you would have, that you would get 30 days warning of war with Pakistan was disproved in 1965. They were able to produce a new armored division, which the Americans had discounted. The Americans were maintaining one armored division, and the Americans continued to say that the Pakistanis only had one armored division. In the event, they produced a second one, by the circumstance that the equipment that they got from the Americans to replace the equipment in a particular armored division, the equipment that was replaced was then thrown up and surreptitiously used in a new armored division. So devices or ploys like that, shall we say, though the Americans claimed that they did not know about it, but nevertheless it is quite clear now from books that have come out recently. One is called Charlie's War, which has come out, which proves that what all the Americans have done to aid Pakistan, and though outwardly they discounted it. An American civil servant has written this book, Charlie Wilson has written this book, Charlie's War. And as I say, it has just come out. And there's another book called The Enemy of My Enemy is My Friend, which of course is a takeoff on Mao Zedong, but which is also written by an American. It shows the deception that the Americans have practiced on India insofar as military aid is concerned. But our main posture was that we would now have our defensive formations not right at the back in the heartland of India, and that they would actually be deployed in cantonments on the border.
Now, with you purchasing equipment from the Soviet Union, did that not mean that there were problems with equipment? Because, I mean, there are different, you know, the different calibers, different types of weapons. Did that lead to problems at the front, or how was it resolved?
Well, basically, we went in for tanks, basically, because Our tanks were a World War II vintage, what the Americans had given as lend-lease. We had in between bought Centurion tanks from the British, but the British now were playing, shall we say, had imposed sanctions in 65, and so therefore the Indo-Soviet Treaty was signed, Treaty of Friendship, in order to get equipment from the Soviet Union. It was a new pattern of equipment, that is correct, but with training, the equipment was absorbed, and I would like to say, in fairness to the Soviet Union, they've tested their equipment in a variety of terrain, because they also have a large landmass, so they can test their equipment in the desert, in Arctic areas. They may not be able to test them in high altitude areas, but they can certainly test them in the desert and in Arctic areas. Whereas our experience of the British equipment, we bought the Vickers tank from the British, when later the Soviet equipment had outlasted their life, and I was, that comes later of course, but the British equipment did not stand up to any tests in the variations in terrain. The British equipment is tested only at this place, Bovington, where you have your test track.
But we'll perhaps come back to that. Which tanks did you actually buy from the Soviet Union? Do you know the type?
So we bought the T-54 initially, which was, it came cheap, and then the T-55. The T-54 they had no problems in providing because they themselves had discarded them, so we got them cheap, because they themselves had by that time in the 60s had equipped their tank and their formations with the T-55. And so we bought both the T-54 and the T-55.
Now, what other lessons did you have from the, you know, you were, as I say, rewriting the orders and
So one lesson was a greater emphasis on night operations.
Tell me about that. Wow.
Well, I mean, to depend entirely on daylight for all the operations, of course, was a lesson also from World War II. You had to get used to night operations. But when you have the so-called modern equipment and tanks and all that, we're apt to get dependent on daylight. The main thing was that night attacks were more likely to succeed, because at that particular point of time, the Pakistanis did not have night vision devices. Of course, they now have, but that is a subsequent development. But by training more, to emphasize your operations at night, you inspired more confidence in the troops, made them more adept at navigation, and shall we say, reaching an objective by night. So all in all, it made for a greater independence, or shall we say, resilience in training.
So now, who are you working? Who was your brigadier? He would be the GSO one. Would he the brigadier?
No, I was the brigadier.
And
I had under me three different lieutenant colonels.
Right. Who was the you said you weren't GSO1 though?
No. I was the brigadier in charge of three GSO1s.
Right, sorry.
So I had a GSO1 operations.
Right.
I had a GSO1 operations who by circumstance, a thorough gentleman, had been commanding the battalion that I'd taken over in Naga Hills, but had then taken leave and left. But when I arrived, the General Officer Commanding in Chief said that since this Lieutenant Colonel had accompanied him on visits to operational formations in 1965, he would like to dictate his so-called dispatches to him. And would I mind if I did his work also, that is the General Staff Officer Operations also, sir? I said I had no objection. So the GSO-1 operations during my time in Headquarters Western Command was not available to me because he was taking down dictation from the General Officer Commanding in Chief on his dispatches on the 1965 operations. I, of course, had General Staff Officers, Grade 1, for weapons and equipment, as also for what you may call staff duties.
Could you describe a bit more about how the staff work? What the whole composition of the staff and how it worked together? Because people don't understand it.
Well, the lieutenant colonels in the General Staff branch all answered to me. But as I say, the one responsible for operations had been taken away to take dictation. So I dealt with his majors, GSO-2 operations, two of them. So I dealt with them direct. There was a GSO-1 training. I drafted the training notes for him. There was a GSO-1 weapons and equipment. I so-called went into detail as to what equipment we should demand from Army headquarters and the General Staff Officer staff duties, who was responsible for various organizational matters. All I wish to say that I should arrive in office at 7:30 in the morning and leave 7:30 at night, for the simple reason that the aftermath of this 1965 war had created its own problems, inasmuch as the revision of the various instructions, procedures, standing orders.
So anything you remember from that time, any other issues you remember from your period at Headquarters Western Command? You were there about a year again, till October 69. Anything else come up, or was it just as you've described?
No, but basically, I mean, there was no war at that particular period. I had to clear up the aftermath of the war and shed daylight, shall we say, on a future war.
Who was in command at the time of Western Command?
There was a Lieutenant General Harbhakt Singh.
Harbhakt
Singh. H-A-R-B-A-K-H.
Singh. What was your relationship like with him?
It was good. I had known him. I'd known him from before. He had been a prisoner of war of the Japanese, had not joined the Indian National Army, had stayed firm with the British. I had first met him when we were staying in the same mess in Delhi. I as a lieutenant colonel and he as a brigadier. So to that extent, I knew him, and as I say, he had asked for me specifically in order to sort the mess out.
What did you think of him as was he a competent, hard-working, intelligent officer? What did you think of him?
He was a very competent tactical field commander. He had a very good eye for ground, and to the extent that Amritsar was not lost in 65 was due entirely to him, in the sense that, as I say, Pakistan had all of a sudden out of the kitty produced a new armored division, which was, shall we say, not known to India, certainly not disclosed to us by the Americans. So when Pakistan had attacked in 1965, they were going to cut the road between Jammu and Srinagar in Kashmir, cut the lifeline of Jammu and Kashmir, an area that they claimed, and they were going to cut it in two places, one near Jammu and one in the north near a place called Kargil. And of course, the idea was, they had been told by the then, Pandit Nehru had died, they had been told by the then Prime Minister of India that if they attacked India, we would counterattack. So that didn't deter them, because they had sort of been in collusion with the Chinese that we will not be able to withdraw the divisions from the Tibet border to face Pakistan. And so they did launch this preemptive attack. In the event, India launched counterattacks both from near Jammu and from near Lahore. It's a sad story that the counterattack from Jammu got bogged down in the minefields laid by Pakistan, and the one at Lahore, which was on the verge of success due to timidity or otherwise, was halted, and thereafter Pakistan then launched its counterstroke in the Punjab with a new armored division, which was not identified earlier. It was one of the battalions of my regiment that saved the situation insofar as this is concerned, because the others had orders to withdraw. But at that point of time, the chief of the Indian Army had sort of agreed that we should withdraw behind the river Bias. But that would have meant losing this holy shrine of the Sikhs, Amritsar. Harbakh Singh, being a Sikh, refused to withdraw. And that is to his eternal credit that he refused and Amritsar was saved. So as a field commander, he was good. He had eye for ground. He's now dead. I used to look him up every fortnight in Delhi. He's left his memoirs, which recently came out last year.
So anything else about your time at Western Command, or should we move on to...
No, I would like to say that he was a good... you asked me the question, he was a good field commander. And that is, of course, by circumstance, as he himself gives in his memoirs, by circumstance of starting as a platoon commander in British days and then not joining the Japanese.
Now, so the next your next posting was in October 69, through till I think September 71, when you were Major General
commanding a division.
Now this is the 14th Infantry Division.
Yes.
At Dera Dun, yes. United Provinces. Now, can you tell us the background to getting this posting, and then we'll go through.
What happened was that this division was going to be exercised in the Punjab. It had to be moved to the Punjab, which was going to be exercised along with the One Armored Division in an exercise that had the name, code name, Spring Fever. But the general officer commanding, a friend of mine of the division called Sarkar, who subsequently committed suicide, he said that he was mentally not fit to command the division and be exercised, as his wife was unwell. She subsequently died. So overnight, I was ordered to move and take over the division and move it to the Punjab for the exercise. Its location at Dera Dun was one of the new concepts. This division had been raised as a result of the 65 operations, and its posture at Dera Dun was keeping a complete division over there was a new concept, keeping it closer to the border. So I took over the division, shook them out for a week by visiting each brigade.
Now, what were you looking for when you visited the brigades? Tell us what a typical brigade inspection would be like.
Well, it was not an inspection of any sort. I would just... they'd already been asked to do a river crossing practice before moving to the Punjab. by my predecessor, so I just went and saw them doing the river crossing training before moving to the Punjab.
But what did you think of your new brigades? I mean, you had by then a pretty good idea.
I think they were well trained. I'm not arguing about that in any way. They were well trained, fit to be exercised. I only had to get to know the brigade commanders and the battalion commanders. And within a week of my taking over, as I say, I moved overnight. Within a week of my taking over, we moved to the Punjab. And we were exercised along with the Armored Division for a role in the event of further hostilities with Pakistan. And really analogous to what the Pakistanis had tried to inflict upon us in 1965, when they had grouped an armored division and an infantry division and had started their thrust to what they called to Delhi, which of course was, shall we say, defeated by the withdrawal behind the river Bias being not agreed to by Lieutenant General Harbakh Singh. So we moved to the Punjab and went through the various tactical maneuvers required to cross into Pakistan in our own territory as a training exercise if in the event hostilities occurred again with Pakistan. That was 1969.
And how did the exercises go, or the maneuvers?
Well, it went very well from my point of view. We did whatever we could alongside the Armored Division, with whom we were to be grouped in operations. But things being what they are, having done this training with the Armored Division, I was then posted out to a new appointment of Chief of Staff Headquarters 1 Corps. Because it was now decided that Headquarters 1 Corps...
See? You were only with them for... You seem to have been there almost a year and a half, though, with 14th Infantry Division.
Yes, but of course the exercise in the Punjab took up at least a couple of months in the sense of moving there, then participating in the exercise, then moving back.
Back to Dehradun.
Back to Dehradun. By the lessons of the exercise and shake out the division to be able to learn from what we had learned from the exercise.
Now, what did you learn?
Well, we learned that to the extent that night operations were more important than there was no scope for daylight operations.
So it reinforced the lessons of the 65 war?
Yes, it did. The problem in the Indian Army is that everything is rotated every 3 years.
What do you mean by that?
Because, for example, you send a battalion to Kashmir for 3 years operational duty on the ceasefire line. After 3 years, it comes back to a peace station like Dehradun. So therefore, within, shall we say, a few months, the personalities and the units that had been exercised in the Punjab in this operational exercise, Spring Fever, would all have been changed. So you're all the time retraining because on this rotational pattern of the Indian Army, which is inevitable on account of being employed in operational areas, even in so-called peacetime. So you've got to rotate the troops, otherwise they'll have no family life. You see, here you all don't have the same problem, because after all, if you're here, you go to Germany. I mean, you're experiencing the trauma now in Iraq. But otherwise, you all have not been subjected to this. No other army in the world, as I say, was subjected to this trauma that the Indian Army has endured ever since 47. Going to the animus by Pakistan.
So, I mean, the lessons that had to be relearned in a sense, because the units kept changing within.
Well, you've got to repeat it, because for example a unit comes from Kashmir, it's not conversant with the river crossing, so you've got to get them to do river crossing all over again. So it may sound like repetition, but it is not repetition in the sense, because you are repeating it for the benefit of new units, new commanders.
Now, anything else you remember about your time in command of that division?
No, when I was commanding that division, there was...
The 14th, sorry.
14th division, there was a telephone battle held at headquarters Western Command, because by now it was quite clear, this was 1971, that Pakistan was up to something again. See, India is in the dilemma that we have all the time been reacting to situations created by Pakistan, and that is why I keep on saying that partition should never have occurred. But one is not blaming the British per se, but it could have been avoided. So now the writing on was on the wall again that something was going to happen, because the Mujibur Rahman in East Pakistan had won the elections, his party had won the elections, and he should have been the Prime Minister of Pakistan. But the West, as though an East Pakistani, but the West Punjabis would not allow or permit an East Pakistani becoming their Prime Minister. Then what was the basis of Pakistan from that point of view? Religion was argued as a basis of nationality, and now it was being argued that language was the basis of nationality. The West Pakistani spoke Urdu, the East Pakistani spoke Bengali. So therefore no Bengali-speaking person could be the Prime Minister. But nevertheless, that is in the morass or quagmire of history. The point that arises is that something was happening, going to happen in what is now Bangladesh. The